And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. And one of the things that makes this such a great nation was a great, big, huge surprise that emerged out of Philadelphia in the very hot, sweltering, humid summer of 1787. What big surprise? Generally, human experience teaches that when a committee tries to invent something, it very rarely turns into a masterpiece. But there's a committee of people. They're all people with substantial egos. They are successful, some of them very successful, some of them world famous, some of them brilliant, some of them not so brilliant. There are 55 people who were called together at one point or another to participate in a constitutional convention to invent an entirely new scheme of government for a new nation, the United States of America. 11 years after declaring independence, all of a sudden the Articles of Confederation that had bound the nation together up till that point weren't working anymore. So they came together to change everything. And the result, out of lots of conflict and lots of compromise, was a masterpiece. That is what constituted the miracle of the Constitution. In this very special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show, we cover the miracle of the Constitution, following as best we can the debates, the conflicts, the close calls, the amazing providential protection that appears to have led to a charter of government that has worked remarkably well for the United States of America. We had 12 of the states all participating, all debating, and in a very spirited way, some very fundamental changes. One of the changes that was most important that the delegates all knew they had to make was to create a federal executive. What was amazing about the Articles of Confederation is there was no executive. People were allergic to the idea of a king. That hadn't worked out so well, they thought, in terms of what was going on back in Britain. So they tried during the Articles of Confederation basically just to have Congress leading the whole way. One House of Congress, the Confederation Congress. Well, now they had to set up an executive. But there were some people who were very afraid that if you had one executive, it would be too much power in the hands of one individual. So they talked about having two, or some people even three, presidents, with the idea that if those presidents were fighting against each other, it would curb their power. It would avoid having some kind of overwhelming power concentrated in the hands of one individual. The folks who argued for one president and only one pointed to the guy sitting in the front of the room. He was on a little raised platform behind a little desk. He said almost nothing during most of the meetings of the Constitutional Convention. His name was Washington. He was from Mount Vernon, Virginia. And he was the most admired man by far, along with Dr. Franklin, who was also there. He was the most admired man by far in the 13 states and the 12 states represented there at the convention. The point being that folks trusted George Washington. They knew that he was going to be the first president. And so they agreed when they voted, okay, we're going to have only one president. Another hot issue that divided the delegates, aside from the issues of slavery, which we've talked about a little bit, another hot issue was whether or not people would get paid for serving in Congress. A number of individuals felt, wait a minute, we shouldn't be paying people. Otherwise, what will happen is Congress will vote increases in its own salary. They'll vote more and more and more. And people will want to come to Congress in order to get rich. But the other side argued that, wait, if we pay nothing to people, then that will limit service in Congress to people who are independently wealthy already. And it will mean that honest working people will have no chance if they have to pay their own expenses to travel great distances, and travel was difficult at that time. So they voted after a spirited debate. Yes, they were going to be able to pay members of Congress. There was one issue that they simply couldn't resolve, and that was the most important issue over which the Constitutional Convention nearly broke up on several occasions. Very, very heated debate. The issue was, how is Congress going to be arranged? The Confederation Congress had only one vote per state. so that the smallest state, Georgia, had the same number of votes as the largest state, Virginia. Each one got only one. And you needed 9 votes to get anything done. As a result, almost nothing got done. The big states, led by Virginia with the Virginia Plan, wanted to replace that idea of one vote per state with proportional representation, having each state wield as much power as its percentage of the population. In other words, if a state was twice as big, it would have twice as many members of Congress. Seemed to make sense to them. The small states said, no, that will allow the 3 big states, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and Virginia, to absolutely dominate, and it will take away our sovereignty and our right to function. This was a huge issue, and it remained an issue after they had decided we're going to have 2 different houses of Congress, not one. And then they voted that the lower house, the most representative house, the House of Representatives, that would be apportioned the way Virginia wanted, according to population. But the small states absolutely resisted the idea that the upper house of the legislature, which later came to be called the Senate, would also be apportioned by population. They insisted there should be 1 senator or just 2 senators for every individual state. This was going to be necessary. And the arguments raged back and forth, and there were strong points obviously made on both sides. James Wilson of Pennsylvania, who, by the way, dominated the debates at the Constitutional Convention, he is one of our crucial founding fathers. He also helped writing the Declaration of Independence. He is almost not remembered today, but he was brilliant. He spoke on the floor of the convention during the summer of 1787 168 times, more than Madison, more than Franklin, more than Hamilton, more than anyone else. And one of the things he said regarding this, he said, why should a national government be unpopular? Has it less dignity? Will each citizen enjoy under it less liberty or protection? Will a citizen of Delaware be degraded by becoming a citizen of the United States? He resisted the idea that what Congress should be was basically just a federation of states. Congress and the federal government, according to James Wilson's view, should be a superior government with the ability to overrule the states, even in determinations that the states made in the legislative level locally. But this was not at all approved by delegates from, well, for instance, New Jersey. The leader for what was called the New Jersey Plan, which was a plan of having apportionment 1 vote per state, was a delegate named Patterson. And William Patterson was an appropriate guy to be an advocate for small states because he was a small guy. He was barely 5'2". And Patterson basically argued that they had not been sent there to abolish state sovereignty. He said, we are met here as the deputies of 13 independent sovereign states for federal purposes. Can we consolidate their sovereignty and form 1 nation and annihilate the sovereignties of our states who have sent us here for other purposes? The people of America are sharp-sighted, said William Patterson. And not to be deceived, the idea of a national government as contradistinguished from a federal one never entered into the mind of any of them. To which Caledonia James, that was the nickname they gave James Wilson because of his thick Scottish burr, he said, can we forget for whom we are forming a government? Is it for men or for the imaginary beings called states? Are not the citizens of Pennsylvania equal to those of New Jersey? Does it require 150 of the former to balance 50 of the latter? He said, if the small states will not confederate on this plan, Pennsylvania, and I presume some other states, will not confederate on any other. They were willing to break apart the Union over this issue. How is it resolved? And how did more of a spirit of compromise and cooperation take hold at the convention? Well, it involved, in part, a number of factors. One of them, the 4th of July. The other, a religious plea from a very old man. And the other, the weather. We'll tell you all about that with the continued story of the miracle of the Constitution. The song Yankee Doodle, of course, inspired the American troops in what they viewed rightly as their miraculous victory over the British and the winning of American independence in the Revolution. But then the question was, you've won the war, but how do you win the peace? How do you create a stable, functioning central government? That's the question behind this very special broadcast called The Miracle of the Constitution. How'd it happen? How'd they do it? What were the obstacles they encountered and how'd they overcome them? Well, the obstacle that they encountered right after the Revolution was the fact that the Articles of Confederation simply didn't work. The states were sovereign. The federal government, the Continental Congress, which became the Confederation Congress, had very, very limited power. One of the problems with that was there was no executive. There was no functioning president. There was no functioning head of the army. There were committees of Congress to see to defense or relations with foreign nations, but no one whose exclusive job that was. And part of the difficulty is there were a great number of foreign threats. And you say, well, what threats could there possibly be to America? We were protected by the big ocean from Britain. But don't forget, the British were empowered up in Canada, and there were still British troops there. And there were still problems and challenges with Indians. Now, the British troops in Canada were making trouble by working with a bunch of potential rebels against the central government down in Vermont. Now, this is all extraordinarily complicated. It's very, very amusing, actually. Ethan Allen, who was one of the heroes with his Green Mountain Boys of the Revolutionary War, particularly the Battle of Ticonderoga, Ethan Allen and his buddies declared an independent republic of Vermont because they couldn't get themselves admitted to the Union. Now, why couldn't they get admitted to the Union and to the Articles of Confederation? The answer is because both New Hampshire and New York claimed the territory of Vermont, and Congress couldn't make up its mind and couldn't decide. So meanwhile, the British are scheming to say, hey, you can have your independent Republic of Vermont join us up in Canada. Now, that would have put a British division right between New England and the Middle Atlantic states. It would have crippled the new nation. There were also problems with these new territories of Tennessee and Kentucky. Over 100,000 Americans right after the Revolution had spilled into that area, and they wanted to be two new states, but the Spanish claimed it. The Spanish took over the Louisiana, what later became the Louisiana Purchase. They took it over from the French. They were also in Florida. They were conspiring with an American general, secretly bribing him. His name was James Wilkinson, who was supposed to lead all these folks in Tennessee, his neighbors, to becoming part of Spain. So these were real threats that the deeply concerned patriotic Americans who wanted to see the success of the new country. The other problems were economic, because each state had its own currency. Each state had its own money system. They didn't trust each other. They didn't cooperate with each other. They had tariffs not only against foreign imports, but often among the states. And this created great financial hardships. It made it very difficult to do business. So they decided, basically, they had one particular problem in terms of arranging the commerce among the states. And they decided, with congressional authorization, to hold a special convention in Annapolis, Maryland. But its only purpose was going to be to try to work out better commercial relationships among the states. And as soon as five state delegations got there to Annapolis, before the rest even arrived, they decided at the Annapolis convention, you know what? We have deeper problems than just commerce. We've got to redo this whole government. So they then went back and asked for another convention, not in Annapolis, but in the biggest city in the country at the time, in Philadelphia, where the Congress had drawn up the Declaration of Independence. They called another convention and asked all the states to send delegates to that convention for a general revision of the Articles of Confederation to fix all of the things that needed fixing. And no one was quite sure what direction they were going to take. One thing that was sure was one state, a very, very obnoxious one, at least it was considered at the time, was the state that came to be known as Rogue Island. During this entire period, from about 1786 until 1790, Rhode Island was known as Rogue Island because they just wouldn't cooperate. They didn't send anybody to the Constitutional Convention. After the Constitution was ratified and the new government was created, Rhode Island said no. They were going to go their own way, but eventually they were forced to comply. But meanwhile, the other 12 states did agree to send some delegates. And basically, they sent the delegates with the only assignment was to revise the basic provisions of the Articles of Confederation. Now, this became urgent because right at the time that they were trying to get the delegates to come down, there was a major rebellion in western Massachusetts. What was it about? It was about a bunch of subsistence farmers and veterans of the Revolutionary War who had begun shutting down local courts to stop foreclosure proceedings. They were in the midst of a recession, and there were attempts to collect debts and taxes by taking away people's land and their only source of livelihood. So eventually, a former captain, a son of Irish immigrants, he was wounded. He had been a captain in the militia. He had fought 5 years with General Washington in the Revolution. He led a revolution. He got 1,500 men to work with him. And they had determined that they were going to, quote, bring down the tyrannical government, not of Britain this time, but of Massachusetts. The three major bands of rebels from all over western Massachusetts converged on Springfield to grab an armory, to grab weapons. And there, before they were got together in Springfield, there was a very lucky break, which is a message among these different groups of rebels was intercepted by the official troops from the Massachusetts militia who were guarding the armory. So they never did get together. They were fired upon separately. This became a very bloody, serious revolution. And the resistance involved four Shaysites who were killed in Springfield. There were 20 others wounded. Eventually, there were 4,000 participants in what was called Shays Rebellion who had to sign confessions and got amnesty in return. This shocked people in every other colony, not just in Massachusetts. George Washington was so shocked that he decided he would participate in the Constitutional Convention, which was key. George Mason of Virginia said, "The eyes of the United States are turned upon this assembly concerning the new Constitutional Convention, and the expectations raised to a very anxious degree. May God grant that we may be able to gratify them by establishing a wise and just government. The revolt from Great Britain and the formation of our new government at that time were nothing compared to that great business now before us. To view through the calm, sedate medium of reason, the influence which the establishment now proposed may have upon the happiness or misery of millions yet unborn is an object of such magnitude as absorbs and in a measure suspends the operation of the human understanding." More on the miracle of the Constitution coming up. What you're hearing right now is the President's March. It was written in 1793 to honor our first president, George Washington, by a German immigrant, and it served for many years as our unofficial national anthem. But right now, we're not in 1793. We're back in 1787 in the summer before there ever was a president of the United States or any form of national executive. There are delegates gathering at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, recognizing that the Articles of Confederation, this loose linking of the states, was terribly ineffective. One of the things that persuaded George Washington himself to go down to Philadelphia, actually up to Philadelphia, because he's coming from his home in Mount Vernon, Virginia. One of the things that persuaded him to make that 150-mile trip to Philadelphia in a special coach and to sit there as president of the convention to preside over the proceedings and the deliberations was Shays' Rebellion, this bloody fight in Massachusetts that scared the dickens out of people throughout the colonies. Washington wrote to his friend Henry Lee just before he left for Philadelphia. He said, "Good God, I am mortified beyond expression when I view the clouds that have spread over the brightest morn that ever dawned in any country. What a triumph for our enemies," he wrote, "to verify their predictions. What a triumph for the advocates of despotism to find that we are incapable of governing ourselves and that systems founded on the basis of equal liberty are merely ideal and fallacious." And then later he wrote to his friend Lafayette back in France, "These disorders are evident marks of a defective government. Indeed, the thinking part of the people of this country are now so well satisfied of this fact that most of the legislatures have appointed, and the rest, it is said, will appoint, delegates to meet at Philadelphia the second Monday in May, the next general convention, in general convention of the states, to revise and correct the defects of the federal system." Well, ultimately, 12 of the 13 states did send delegates, though they arrived somewhat late. The two first delegations to arrive were Pennsylvania. Obviously, it was the convention was being held in Philadelphia, so that was easy. And then Virginia, which was the most powerful, the most important delegation, and included General Washington. Washington took up residence as a house guest of one of the Pennsylvania delegates, Robert Morris, who was the richest man in the colonies, the most successful banker and financier. And the Morris Mansion was considered to be one of the most gracious homes on the continent. It was said to rival anything in London. And the other convenience was Washington could walk. He could stroll over to the State House in Philadelphia. It was the State House for the state of Pennsylvania. Today it's known as Independence Hall. The building still stands. And they were meeting very deliberately in the same room where they had signed the Declaration of Independence back in 1776, some 11 years before. So also within easy walking distance of where Washington was staying was another landmark in Philadelphia, the home of 81-year-old Benjamin Franklin. He was the other world-famous figure besides Washington who was there. And while they were waiting for the other delegations to arrive, Franklin decided, "I'm going to have a big blowout dinner for all of these Virginia delegates." He was a great admirer of Washington, as everyone was at the time. So he invited all of those who had showed up to Philadelphia to this big dinner at his home. And those delegates were almost entirely from either Pennsylvania or Virginia. They were very surprised, however, when their host replaced the sweet wine that was customarily served on such occasions with porter. Porter is a strong, dark, hearty, very alcoholic English beer. Later, Franklin happily reported to the brewer in London that he had bought the beer from that when the cask was broached, the company agreed unanimously that it was the best porter they had ever tasted. Philadelphia is hot and humid in the summer. Was then, still is. They drank a lot. Part of the miracle of the Constitutional Convention is that with all of this drinking, they managed to achieve some pretty memorable work. Here's something that's pretty amazing. Later on in the heat of the summer, there was another dinner for 12 delegates, and the account book showed that those 12 delegates drained 60 full bottles of sweet Madeira wine. This led, well, it didn't lead to immediate agreement, but the dinner at Franklin's house led to a little bit of a conspiracy between the Virginia delegates and the Pennsylvania delegates about their plan for hijacking the convention. How'd that work out? We'll continue that story in this special broadcast, The Miracle of the Constitution.
Now it's time for MedVed's Entertainment Minute.
A remarkable new documentary gives you an almost minute-by-minute sense of the unfolding horror of one of the most significant days in American history. It's called 9/11, Inside the President's War Room. Now streaming on Apple TV+.
September 11th, 2001.
We went from a calm, beautiful day to one in which our world changed dramatically.
That's President George W. Bush, in fact, who gave these filmmakers unique access, as did Vice President Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, and most of the other important figures who played a role on that fateful day. Even though most Americans know what happened, this gorgeously made film uses the vivid emotional recollections of leading decision makers to recapture their own confusion and near panic in dealing with this devastating, unprecedented attack on American civilians. Some of the horror and immediacy of the footage of destruction at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon makes this definitely an adults-only experience. 4 stars for the extraordinary, unforgettable 9/11 inside the President's War Room.
You're listening to a very special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show, The Miracle of the Constitution. And the Constitutional Convention delegates from Virginia and Pennsylvania had just enjoyed a very merry evening at the home of Dr. Franklin. Benjamin Franklin was one of the most famous people in the world. In fact, there are some people who say he was the most famous single citizen of the world at the time. He was known as an inventor. The lightning rod had changed everything. The Franklin stove was a bestseller. Bifocals, which Ben Franklin had invented, were used all around the world. He was known as a publisher, as an author, as the author of aphorisms, early to bed, early to rise, make a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. And Ben Franklin tried to illustrate that provision. He was also known as a diplomat. He was the one who had helped to negotiate French participation, helping America in the Revolution, which allowed us to win. So it was considered a great honor to have lots and lots of porter beer, which they did, and they enjoyed enormously when the Pennsylvania and Virginia delegations met at Ben Franklin's house. But the business that they were up to was figuring out how to direct the Constitutional Convention. And that night, they had determined that we're going to do more than just revise the Articles of Confederation. We need a whole new scheme of government. And fortunately, one of the Virginians, James Madison, who was tiny, he was, depending on the sources you believe, he was somewhere between 5'4 and 5'6. He was always very frail. He never weighed more than 100 pounds. A very slight, scholarly gentleman, but he had laid out a whole scheme of government, which is why we call him the father of the Constitution. And this was codified in the Virginia Plan. So in one of the very, very early meetings of the Constitution, Edmund Randolph, who was the then governor of Virginia, he was dashing, he was in his early 30s, he was considered very handsome and a Revolutionary War hero, and he stood up and he delivered the Virginia Plan. And the Virginia Plan called for some things that we would recognize.
You're listening to a best of the Michael Medved Show as Michael is out today observing the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur. You're listening to a special best of the Michael Medved Show. If you want to go into the archives and visit the radio shows from 2015, 2010, and even before, become a Medhead at michaelmedved.com.
Edmund Randolph, who was the then governor of Virginia, he was dashing, he was in his early 30s, he was considered very handsome and a Revolutionary War hero, and he stood up and he delivered the Virginia Plan. And the Virginia Plan called for some things that we would recognize. The ineffective Congress of the Articles of Confederation, where they needed 9 votes to achieve anything of the 13, and they didn't often get a quorum, and each state had only 1 vote, that was scrapped. There would now be 2 houses of Congress. There'd be a People's House, a House of Representatives, where the members would serve 3 years each, and then that House of Representatives would elect an upper house, a Senate. But they'd do that based upon nominations submitted by state legislatures. And Congress could be overruled by a combination of the president overruling Congress together with a judicial council of the judiciary. Most important to the Virginia plan and most radical, and something that was an item of hot debate at the Constitutional Convention, the Virginia plan gave the new federal government the right to strike down any state laws that they didn't like, which really put an end to the idea of sovereign states. Now, why did Virginia do that? One of the things that Virginia cared about was having power requisite to Virginia's dominant position in terms of population, in terms of the size of the state. At the time, of course, Virginia included what later became the separate state of West Virginia, and it was by far the most influential state. What was the second most populous and influential? Pennsylvania. So this axis of Virginia and Pennsylvania, later when the delegates arrived, the delegates of Massachusetts and other big states joined with them, the big states wanted the idea of having both a lower house and an upper house, both of which would be apportioned based on population. And they would then have a very, very powerful new federal government. But none of this was going to be so easy to sell to the delegates of the other states. And they needed to do that to have any chance of success with the Constitutional Convention. Here is the fact that allowed them to do that were two decisions that they made very early on at the beginning of the Constitutional Convention. One of those decisions was to keep it secret. Now, why was that so important? Well, because, as you can imagine, we had just gone through a revolution. People all over the colonies, and particularly in Philadelphia — Philadelphia was amazing, it was a city of 50,000 at the time, by far the biggest in then the United States — but it had, for 50,000 people, 12 newspapers, and all the newspapers want to find out what's happening. And what they did, despite the fact that it's hot in Philadelphia in the summertime and they had no air conditioning, they closed the shutters and drapes in Independence Hall in the Pennsylvania State House so no one could look in, no one could listen in. The deliberations would be entirely secret. And without that secrecy, it's extremely likely that these politicians who were gathering in Philadelphia and arriving gradually there, they would have had no success. The other was a decision that was made by General Washington. And Washington, of course, was considered beyond reproach. He was a great hero. There's a terrific story that's told about Benjamin West, who was a famous painter of the era. He was an American who had gone over to England, where he had a great success. And he painted King George III at one point. And at the very end of the Revolution, they're walking in the garden, the painter Benjamin West, the American, and King George III. And George III asked Benjamin West, "What do you hear of your fellow citizens back in the colonies, former colonies?" And he said, "Well, General Washington has left the army and he's going home to farm in Virginia." And King George said, "He's not becoming a monarch?" And no. And King George said, "Then he will be the greatest man in the world." And Washington, only reluctantly coming back to preside over the Constitutional Convention, had great prestige, and he made the decision that every different item would be debated and voted on separately. In other words, some of the Virginians initially wanted to, "We have the Virginia plan, let's put our whole plan up to a vote, see how it goes." Washington knew it would be voted down. It was too sweeping. It had too many controversial elements. So every single point of change, every single point of arranging the government would be voted separately and would be voted only after very, very spirited debate. Now, the Constitutional Convention came very close to breaking up at several points because there was one issue above all others that passionately divided people, that threatened their deliberations. What was that issue? No, it wasn't slavery, though there were hot debates about that, of course. We'll tell you what that one crucial divisive issue was in the continuing amazing story, The Miracle of the Constitution.
The Michael Medved Show.
One of the emphases of American conservative ideology has always been local control.
Your source for breaking news and uncensored views.
The closer you can bring government and decision-making to a locality, the more directly you can liberate people, and you can actually have government policy follow the will of the people.
It's The Michael Medved Show.
This special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show will be available in its entirety from the Medved History Store. That's medvedhistorystore.com. The subject, the miracle of the Constitution. Yes, they were divided over slavery at the Constitutional Convention. A number of our founding fathers were profoundly anti-slavery. That was true of John Adams, who wasn't at the Constitutional Convention. He was away in England serving as our minister to London. It was certainly true of Dr. Franklin. It was true of Alexander Hamilton, who was very much part of the convention. And the fact is that one of the anti-slavery leaders was a slave owner who had come to feel guilty about owning 200 slaves. His name was George Mason of Virginia. And he wanted the Constitution to ban the further slave trade. He eventually agreed to a compromise. The compromise held to it that up until 1808, Congress couldn't eliminate the slave trade. But in 1808, 20 years after the Constitution was adopted, they could. And everyone expected that they would. And they, in fact, did eliminate the importation of new slaves. The other issue about slavery was, how do you count slaves when you're apportioning members of the House of Representatives or members of Congress? Remember, Virginia wanted the Senate to also be apportioned by population. Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts said, look, since the South considers slaves property, there's no more reason to count them for tax purposes or for apportionment purposes than there is to count horses or dogs. Now, it sounds terrible, but you understand why the North would not want all of the slaves who were owned by the South to give them more power. That's how they eventually came to this three-fifths compromise, which was so embarrassing and awful, that for the purposes of apportionment and for the purpose of taxation, a slave would be counted as a person, but only three-fifths of a person. And part of the reason, the argument of that, was that the Virginia in particular wanted wealth, which was counted in terms of the number of slaves you owned, to also be part of how much you were represented. They were able to compromise on the slavery-related issues. What was very difficult for them to compromise on was whether the small states would be protected. The small states, led by New Jersey and Georgia and Connecticut to some extent and some of the others, did not want a situation that Virginia wanted, where Congress would be entirely apportioned by population. Then everything would be dominated by Virginia and Pennsylvania and Massachusetts. This threatened to break apart the whole thing. And it took some miraculous occurrences for this group to stay together and to actually draft a constitution that has worked remarkably well over the years. We will continue this story and tell you about some of the indelible personalities and events that shaped the miracle of the Constitution, which in turn has shaped this greatest nation on God's green earth.